Well, good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming to the session. I'm Adrian Moore. I'm Reason's Vice President of Policy, and we're gonna have a panel here that sort of builds on some of the themes from that video. Sandy Springs is a great story. I mean, and the video tells its basic story pretty well. It's been emulated, and hopefully will be emulated a lot more. A number of other cities in Georgia, upon seeing how well things work for Sandy Springs, we're like, hey, we want some of that. Our county stinks too. And so these communities followed a very similar path, incorporated, outsourced most of their functions. And there's also a couple of cities in Colorado that have done a similar model. So it's our hope, and Lynn might touch on this a little, that we'll get some more places to do this. The other thing that we hope is that it fosters the evolution of privatization of city services. Because one thing that you might notice in that story is Sandy Springs figured out a great way to get all the traditional services that government provides at about half the cost, roughly speaking. They didn't get less government services. So they've sort of taken step one in the evolution that we want local governments to go down, which is to figure out that the private sector can do things better and cheaper. Step two is to figure out, well, why do you even have the government as the middleman? Why don't we just get them out of the picture and let people consume those services if they want, rather than still having the city government decide everybody's going to consume all of these services? And they haven't shrunk the scope of government. They've privatized the mechanism. So actually shrinking the scope of government is the next step. And the great thing about a place like Sandy Springs is you talk to people in Sandy Springs and they're realizing, hey, you know what? You know, it's easy for me to imagine why we wouldn't need the government as a middleman, because I see a private company collecting my trash every day. I think if next month I had to get on the phone and call three different trash companies and say, who'll pick up my trash for the least amount of money, that wouldn't be too traumatic. And I could take the government out as a middleman and it wouldn't upset my world. And that's the kind of evolution that I think Sandy Springs is pushing in a way that that you can't really get anywhere else. It's a tremendous battle. As up until the very minute that Lisa got up here this morning, I was on a conference call. There's a little largely Hispanic town just up the freeway a ways here in Southern California that wants to privatize its water and wastewater system. And they've asked me to help out. And so I've been going to these public meetings and basically pointing out, look, here's what you can get if you privatize your water and wastewater system. Because they're in a situation, they're going to have to raise rates, which nobody wants to pay higher rates. But the fact is their system's old and decrepit. It has to be rebuilt. That costs money. If you want to have your system continue to function, you have to spend the money to do it. The question is, do they privatize the system and have rates go up maybe 25%? Or do they continue to have the city do it and have rates go up 50%? Well, you think that would be a no-brainer, but it's not, because the local government employees unions have called their big brother, the big national unions, and they've sent in their lawyers and their lobbyists and their activists. And so you have this, the city is saying, well, you know, the city government is saying, well, we're just putting this on the table. The private companies that involved, obviously, they're an interested party, so nobody really believes anything they have to say. So it really is, in sort of meeting after meeting, it's Adrian Moore and Reason versus the national unions having this debate in front of a room like this full of citizens who are screaming and yelling, and the public employees are waving their signs and chanting and booing and hissing every time I stand up and talk, and following me out to my car and glaring at me. It's good times. But you know, I so far things are churning along. The surveys still say people support it, so I think we're going to win on that one, and it'll all come out well in the long run. And again, hopefully in Rialto they will realize, hey, what do you know? The private sector can run the water system. Maybe if I get my water and sewer from a private company, it's not, you know, world shattering. It doesn't require the government in order to provide these basic services. So anyway. Our panel this morning is, first we're going to have Len Gilroy, who's Director of Privatization for Reason, and who worked intensively, almost mind-numbingly, with Sandy Springs when they were forming that city government. Oliver Porter, the gentleman in the video, is a great old guy. And he was really like the engine behind this. But he knew he only had the concept. I'm like, it's a no-brainer that we could do this. But how do you do it? How do you actually put it together? How would it work? What do we know we can and can't do and everything? And so that's where Len came in, who had to come in again and again and help with that process, along with Jeff Siegel, who worked on this stuff for Reason before with Len. But Len, similarly with the state of Arizona, state of Utah, Governor Jindal in Louisiana, works with these government officials who actually want to privatize stuff and helping them figure out how to do it, how to make the case, how to analyze things, how to pick priorities, how to put the business process together, and so forth. So Len's going to talk about some of that. Tim Kavanaugh is a journalist with Reason. He was formerly with the LA Times, and he's got one of the more interesting bits in every issue of Reason magazine. He's got a column at the end, and he's got a little cartoon that goes with that. It's one of my favorite parts of the magazine because it's a little bit of a Where's Waldo deal. You have to look at that little cartoon because there's always something embedded in that thing that reflects some aspect of the article. And sometimes it's pretty darn amusing, but Tim's going to talk about kind of the legal framework for actually turning around this incredible pension, public government employee pension overhang we have in the U.S. And because, the fundamental question, anybody who's sort of, delved into it a little bit reading a few articles is, these pension guarantees are contracts between the government and these public employees. So it's not like a lot of other policies where you can just change your mind as a group of political leaders and say, oh yeah, we're not going to do that, sorry. Because they can go to courts and the courts will say, no, you made a contract with these people, you can't do that. So unwinding it's a little more challenging than unwinding a lot of other stupid policies, and Tim's going to talk about that. And then Anthony Randazzo, who's Director of Economic Policy at Reason, focuses on the national economic policy issues playing out in Washington, D.C., and has identified a few really key opportunities we have over the next couple years, the biggest one being there's a real chance we can maybe completely kill Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, or at a minimum, shrink them down to mere shadows of their former selves. Of course, the goal is, stake right through the heart, turn into dust like a vampire in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So let's just hope. So Anthony has, as David mentioned last night at dinner, Anthony's organized this group of all the free market folks who work on that issue in D.C., and they've really just been pounding away at this issue, and Anthony's going to talk some about, what that entails and what the pieces of that are and what we hope will actually happen. And then after that, we'll have questions across that whole spectrum. So with that, Len, come on up.
Thanks, Adrian. I appreciate the introduction. I wanted to start and just say happy tax day to everyone. Actually, it's not officially tax day. The feds can't even get that right. Today should be tax day, but now they've moved it to Monday, I guess, to give you a couple of extra days, not realizing that some states actually did not move that date. So if you wanted to complete your state taxes, you had to finish your federal ones first because the numbers plug into the, one flows from into the other. So even the feds mangled that. But, happy tax day. How does it feel to be the guy there dangling from the Leviathan? I actually always envisioned it more of an octopus with tentacles, and the tentacles could just keep sprouting out into an infinite web. A few years ago, at Reason Weekend, right after the financial crisis, we had a panel, and we were talking about privatization, what's going to happen in government reform. And I told you then that we were looking at boom times for privatization and reform. And the good news, I can tell you, I'm sort of, you can think of me as a privatization thermometer. If I'm busy, that's good. That's good for all of the taxpayers. And I can tell you that I have been busy. It's happening. And as one of our staff, you know, at the epicenter of state and local government reform, primarily in my work, you know, I can tell you I'm seeing it all around me. I'm seeing all sorts of things. You know, as one proxy measure, I edit Reason's annual privatization report. And this year, there was so much going on that we had over 200 pages of content. I ended up having to split it up into 9 different sections because just so people could read it, because there were so many things going on. You know, but at the same time that there's a lot of activity, really more than I've seen in all of my time at Reason, I'm still surprised that we're not seeing more. Maybe I'm impatient, that could be it, but I would think with the level of crisis that we'd even be seeing more, and I'm gonna talk a little bit about that. So if you'll indulge me, I just wanna spend a few minutes contextualizing this for you and offering some highlights and even maybe a few lowlights from the world of government reform right now. So just some quick context. There's no possible way in 10 minutes or so that I can tell you the scope of everything. I would refer you to that annual privatization report for some of that. But I'm going to give you some quick hits here and give you a flavor of what I'm seeing out there. So we've got problems. Obviously, I just want to put some numbers on this for you. You know, just looking at what the states have, the budget deficits that states have closed up until now, you're looking at over $170 billion. And with that, we're not done yet, folks. We're still looking at another almost $150 billion in budget deficits at the statewide level. That's aggregate across all the states through fiscal year 2013. The National Governors Association and the National Association of State Budget Officers, who are, they're certainly not rabid right-wingers, they're out there predicting that we're looking at a lost fiscal decade for states. Take Japan, apply it here in the states. Same thing at the local level, obviously. National League of Cities is projecting somewhere between about $60 to $80 billion in aggregate deficits, and that was just from last year and this year and next year. So really what the way that we've gotten through this up until now is to kick the can down the road, to do budget gimmicks, accounting gimmicks, shift days of when funds transfer so you can just kind of get across a mythical line to make the math work out on paper. But really all that is doing is just pushing the problem down the road. Just think California and you know what I'm talking about. With the scale and the scope of the problems that we have today, that can kicking is not gonna work and the old tried and true methods certainly aren't gonna work. So again, I'm not gonna sit here and try to give you a widespread focus of reform. Instead, I'm gonna zoom down into just a couple of areas. And one of the more interesting ones that we engaged in at Reason over the last year was working with Governor Christie's team in New Jersey. And so I wanna give you a little highlight story about that, and then put that in a bigger picture of some of the reforms that are going on in Jersey right now. So last year, in March, Governor Christie signed an executive order creating the New Jersey Privatization Task Force. Within about 2 hours of that signing of the executive order, I got a call from a former congressman who was appointed as a chairman for that, saying, and basically it was, "You don't know me, but I heard you guys are the ones who know privatization, so can you help?" And of course, the answer was yes. And so I ended up doing a deep dive with them for about 3 months, pretty intensive work in Trenton on day-long conference calls, all sorts of things, all kinds of activity. And I served as an advisor to the privatization task force. And so the task force was charged with finding $50 million. They had already built that into the budget. So they needed to find $50 million. But because of the way the schedule worked, they were halfway through the year, the fiscal year already. So to make that level of savings, what they really needed to do was find about $100 million in savings, that you could just start capturing for that first half of the year. Well, fast forward to the end, we did a lot of work there. They exceeded that. Identified about 40, I think it was about 43 privatization recommendations, which added up to about $210 million in annual cost savings. And that $210 million was really only about half of those 40 recommendations, because there were many of them that you could not estimate the cost of. And it wasn't because we or the task force could not estimate those costs, it was because the state could not provide the data that we needed to even understand what the costs were. So that's a big problem, and that's why these things are really difficult and it's like pulling teeth. But you can see there's a range of things. This isn't all of them, of course, but it runs the gamut through corrections and parks and vehicles, some of the internal admin type functions, psychiatric hospitals, all sorts of things. But that's not all of it. Well, first of all, so what happened with that? Well, Governor Christie is one of those rare breed of politicians who actually looks at recommendations like that and starts trying to do it. Imagine that. That's the whole point, right? So right now, today in New Jersey, there's 8 things that I identified just out of my recent news clips. I'm sure there's other things going on, or maybe they're thinking of more, but they're looking at privatizing all the New Jersey Transit parking at all of the 80-plus park and ride lots and throughout the state. New Jersey Network, they had a TV station, a state-owned TV station. So that was another one. They're spinning off into a nonprofit structure. The toll collectors on the turnpike, as Bob Poole has told you and will tell you for forever, we're in the 21st century, folks. You don't need people in booths to take your toll. You can have electronics and technology do this. So that's a battle that's going on right now with the toll collectors who are trying to preserve their jobs. Contaminated site cleanup, looking at the hazardous waste sites that the state could not manage. They have a backlog of about 30,000 polluted contaminated sites that the state's been sitting on that they cannot get through to get the cleanup done. So they basically said, what if we allowed private contractors to come in and the property owner could hire them instead of waiting for the state to get around to you? What that means, just to put into context, if you're sitting on a piece of property, you can't do anything with it because it's a hazardous waste site. You're not going to sell it. You're not going to build anything on it. You're not going to make any money from it. It's out of economic commerce. So this is an idea to get land back into economic commerce. I won't go through the rest, although golf courses, I've never heard a compelling rationale for a public interest in low greens fees. So, I'm glad to see that they've taken these state-owned golf courses, which I can't remember offhand from the research, but I'm pretty sure they lose money. And now they probably will make money. Racetracks. Same story, I won't even go there. And roadside assistant, in an era of AAA and many other and insurance companies providing roadside assistance, do you really need state employees coming to try to fill your tire or give you a gallon of gas to get to the next exit? But that's not all he's doing. There's other reforms going on, eliminating dozens of boards and commissions, those tentacles in government that just seem to pop up and stay there forever and soak up tax dollars, including the Agent Orange Commission. I'm still trying to figure out what that, or the Commemorative Coin Design Commission for New Jersey. That's fantastic. Pension and benefits reform. I'll leave this to Tim to talk more about, but they've passed laws requiring 401ks for future workers, limiting pensions, and also contributing, asking the employees to contribute 1.5% of their salary toward health care as opposed to zero. And Adrian and I happened to be in Trenton the day that became an issue, and we go down to get a coffee or something, and we see a busload of these public employees. This is a Monday, by the way, at like 11 o'clock. Busloads of public employees flowing out of the buses with these red T-shirts, CWA, Communication Workers of America, that's their union, don't hurt us. And they had clowns. Do you remember that? They had clowns marching in. They were stacking the deck in the State House when we were there. We were just marveling at this display. It was just absurd. Theater of the absurd. And there's other proposals there. I'll skip through. Just some other places to watch. There's a few current governors in the states that are doing some good things. Governor Jindal in Louisiana, we've been working with his administration. You heard about the school choice and the weighted student formula, student-based budgeting work that Lisa's been doing. I've been working with them for a while now on a variety of privatization measures, and the good news is they're getting it done. Virginia, Governor Bob McDonnell, he's still in his first or second year, but is advancing the ball on government reform. Now Virginia's been historically a pretty well-run state relative to the others, which is pretty low bar. But Bob McDonnell is certainly one to watch. Puerto Rico, some of you may have went on the cruise and got to meet him in person. This is one of my favorites, Governor Fortunio. Not only has he cut, I think it was 16,000 government jobs in Puerto Rico government. But he's also got the most widespread, comprehensive, robust, and ambitious infrastructure privatization program going, where they've got roads, schools, prisons, water, all sorts of other things that are out for bid now. Just at the local level, another guy to watch is the mayor in Indianapolis, another sort of epicenter of reform historically. Mayor Greg Ballard is certainly doing good things there. Now, you know, I for the newer breed and the newer crop of governors, I would say watch Florida. Obviously, Rick Scott is out there. He's on a tear right now. And they've got massive, and there's a reason. They've got massive problems. I'd say watch John Kasich in Ohio. He's of that same sort of ilk. They're putting all sorts of things out there in terms of privatization and, you know, pensions and all sorts of other administrative functions. Scott Walker as well. We had the opportunity, Anthony and I went up there when Scott Walker was still the county executive in Milwaukee County, to talk to them about what they could do with their assets, what they could sell or lease or privatize. And so I've been watching him for years, and I always said that he was sort of the lone guy out there against an intransigent county board that had wanted nothing to do with privatization. They were, you know, union sycophants, and they roadblocked him every way. But this was the guy. I've been writing about him for years. He was the guy that would go to the mat for privatization. And then when I saw he was running for governor, and then he actually won, I was like, wow, you know, I hope he takes that to the state of Wisconsin. And certainly it seems like so far it looks promising. I've also got my fingers crossed on the other side. I think Andrew Cuomo is a guy to watch. Now, I'm not going to say, you know, that they're doing anything yet, but I'm going to say watch New York and watch Jerry Brown. These guys are, both of them are in unique positions where the dynamics, the typical dynamics of the politics may not play out right. I mean, these guys have major fiscal challenges, and they're going to have to deal with it. And certainly Cuomo's father was interested in privatization. He's the one who coined the phrase, it is not government's job to provide services, but merely to ensure that they are provided. So, but still, I'm frustrated. You know, I want to see more of this stuff. It should not be this tricky to limit the size and scope of government. Where's this great deleveraging that we're supposed to be upon right now? I mean, we're seeing, and it's happening. It's a fits and starts, and it's tenuous, but it's moving. But, you know, really, look at Europe. That's what I want to see going on in the States. Where are the austerity measures that we hear about all the time? You know, you've got tens and billions in privatization initiatives going on, asset sales, big state-run industries, all sorts of things planned for Greece and Spain and Portugal and Russia and many of the other Western and Eastern European countries. Major public sector job cuts. You've seen the protests. You've seen what that looks like. It's not that different from Wisconsin a few weeks ago. And then this is my favorite, Cuba. They're cutting about 500,000 government jobs, and they're starting to open up the door to privatization. There was a thing on CNN last night about that, interviewing Cuban citizens saying that this is the best thing that, you know, could have possibly happened to them, is to have some limited step into enterprise and markets. So if they can do this, why can't we here? Why can't we pull off the austerity measures? Where's the state austerity measures? You know, and I would say that, like the air traffic controllers out there, the U.S. policymakers are still a little bit asleep at the job. You know, getting these guys to release their death grip on public assets or public services is really like pulling teeth. I can tell you, because you know, I often walk into these engagements that we do in implementation thinking big things, and then you realize quickly the bureaucracy in the process is really not there yet. We're going to have to get them baby steps along the way. I mean, unfortunately, that's the case. I'll just give you a quick example. State-run liquor monopolies. This is fun. I was a part of Governor McDonald's in Virginia, part of his, I was on his advisory team on his first round of trying to privatize the Virginia Alcoholic Beverage Control. And this is state-run wholesale and retail of liquor. Those of you that live in about 32 states out there have no idea what I'm talking about, because you can go buy spirits at your grocery store. But Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and about 15 other states have some version of state control in wholesale and retail of liquor. Tell me if that's a core function of government. I was in Pennsylvania yesterday testifying on this, you know, and I am in a Democrat policy committee, and these guys were really going to the mat to defend it, as if this is good jobs and we're keeping people safe. And if we limit access to alcohol, then we're doing our public duty. And ironically, I testified right after the CFO of the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board, who at the same time he was demonizing privatization of these privateers that just want to sell liquor and, you know, hurt Pennsylvanians and hurt families. Immediately after that, he said, but guys, you know what? We can do more for you if you just stick with us as the public sector. Well, you know what? Maybe you could let us do Sunday sales and give us some more ability to do more marketing and more of this. And then he ended up actually saying, we want to act more like a business. And I'm thinking to myself, wait, you're just demonizing the privateers, and then you're saying you want to act more like entrepreneurial and like a business. Don't you see the hypocrisy here? Parking assets is another one I've been involved in. You know, Chicago, Indianapolis have started to divest themselves of city-owned parking assets. And again, tell me if there's a core function of government, you know, that is served by that by government-owning parking assets. I don't see it. So let me wrap up with, I am an optimist. I'm a glass half full guy, but I'm going to give you the reality check here. Government reform is very tricky. You know, we've got crises abound. If this was your family having the same financial problems that governments have, you would be freaking out and you'd be doing something about it. You'd be cutting your spending. You'd be, you know, you'd be doing all sorts of activities. But in government, it doesn't work that way. You get the same old folks, the unions and the nanny staters and the it ain't broke people that really influence the debate still. And reform, it's not easy. You know, government didn't expand overnight. It's not going to cut and dissolve overnight. It takes a long time. It's purposefully built that way. It's purposefully built to be slow and to create labyrinths of rules and regulations. So undoing all that is like, getting rid of thorns and weeds and bushes. It's hard. It's not cookie cutter either. So one solution in one place can be adapted to another, but it takes work and it takes contextualization and it takes a lot of effort. Executive will, or the lack thereof, is certainly it. Policymakers have to be ready to step up. And there's certainly many risks along the way politically if you want to undo the status quo. And so I often say that good enough for government work really applies to policymakers as well. We often typically think of it as, you know, the guys out on the line, but policymakers, good enough for government work. You see it every day in your states, you do. So I'll just end with this. So I've been noodling on this. Why is it slow? And I'm getting to this point where I'm thinking, well, there's a paradox in privatization. And, despite all the abundant evidence hitting us in the head or hitting policymakers in the head of failure in government, disasters fiscally, we still are fickle about the private sector. We will go out and eagerly camp out overnight to go and spend $600-$700 on the brand new iPad 2 that comes out. Right? Because we know that Apple's given us something we want. It's beautiful. It influences our lives. It makes life better and easier. But then at the same time, we don't take that same model and then apply it to schools and prisons and all the other things that are part of the public sector. Roads, you know, all the things that we talk about all the time. And so I think there's this cultural doublethink here that we're going to have to, you know, get through. We're holding two simultaneously conflicting beliefs that, one, the private sector does lots of great things for us, but we can't trust them in government. It's silly. But that's where we are. And cognitive inertia in society is tough to break, but that's what we're trying to do here. So with that, I will turn it over to Tim, and thank you. Looking forward to your questions. Thanks.
Hi, thanks a lot. Len, by the way, you're not exaggerating about the ability of the unions to bust people in. I was at we were covering for Reason TV for a video you can see online, a rally by a bunch of unions in downtown LA. It had about 8,000 or 9,000 people, and all of the public parking lots in the area were almost empty at the time, and the lot of the Staples Center was just this long line of buses and school buses and so forth, and I really think we need a green initiative requiring all unions to arrive at rallies by high-speed rail. I'm a last-minute addition, which I think is a violation of California work rules, but it also means that I don't have any visuals to show you. I'm just going to talk about the legal framework for pension reform, not just to help you all to get to sleep, but because there's, I think, some interesting hidden in plain sight details in the history of court decisions ruling how we deal with these contracts. It's also something that is of interest to us as libertarians. I mean, I think we all can kind of understand the idea that there's sanctity to a contract, and we've seen with the GM, with what happened to the bondholders in the GM bankruptcy, and what the Obama administration is trying to do right now in terms of forcing cram downs for mortgages and so forth, that we want to be very careful when we're doing these reforms, that we don't want to give the government any new leeway to get out of contracts. Traditionally, the way to get out of contract is to go into bankruptcy. Unfortunately, the examples that we've seen, including right here in Orange County in the 90s, is that the bankruptcy happens, and then somehow the politicians in their wisdom decide that the union contracts are not the thing they're going to get out of. The pension obligations happen in Vallejo as well. So The thing to think about now is how much are these contractual obligations? What is the history of court decisions that have given us all either the reality or the impression that these are as unbreakable as we would think of contracts? First thing to note is that that public employee pension guarantees are treated more as having more more legal force than private sector employee contracts. So there's no reason why that is, and there isn't a lot of precedent for that either. What you have repeatedly, especially in California, and I'm going to focus really specifically on California for a couple reasons. One is that's what I cover. Two, it would really be preferable to have these things settled by state courts. There are a lot of people who want to get a Supreme Court decision on this. My friend Marcia Fritz, who runs a pension reform group up in Citrus Heights, says that it just takes too long at the California level. We need to go to the Supreme Court. Once you do that, though, then you're at the risk of whatever they decide, and that becomes the law of the land nationally. So I'm going to focus just on California decisions. And what you see, although there are a lot of decisions I think most of the people in this room would not be happy with, you also don't see anybody really saying these contracts are fully in weight the way they're treated in California. The way they're treated right now is that the day that you sign on, you become a garbage collector or teacher or whatever, you have not only, you're fully vested not only in all the pension benefits that you have accrued so far, but all the ones that you will accrue into the future through a series of pretty cockamamie court decisions, but all of them featuring language that can be revisited and might yield some new opportunities for us. There's the history of public employee pensions is, these started out as sort of gratuities back in the days of the spoils system and of when these were just patronage jobs that you went down to the local, ward boss and got your job in exchange for, taking a baseball bat and making sure everybody voted the right way on election day. These were not viewed as binding obligations. That slowly evolved. There are only two states left that still use the gratuity theory in dealing with pensions, and even those states have not had a lot of luck in rolling back what public employees get now. So the new model was to treat them as part of your compensation package. Everybody's sort of familiar with this. Your pension traditionally as a public sector worker has been considered part of your compensation. And the traditional trade-off was always, you don't get paid a lot up front, but you get a pretty nicely guaranteed retirement. That's gone completely out of whack, as we all have seen. Everywhere you can track a public sector job to a private sector job, the public sector job pays more in actual dollars today. Your salary is higher. Plus, you get all kinds of things that no longer exist in the private sector, defined benefit pensions and so forth. So that has gone completely, the tail has come to wag the dog in that. What we're looking at now is rolling back pensions. You can always have leeway on salaries, and you're going to see a lot more. I mean, one of the weird elephants in the room about all of this is that we keep fighting over the inviolability of pensions in the future. When we're laying off people right now, we're seeing all these reductions in government services are happening because actual government employees are getting laid off. So now to the legal framework. California has a long, the California courts have a long history of ruling on various court cases, some of which don't seem immediately binding on what we're talking about in some cases where the widow of a pensioner was sued in order to get her benefits jumped up because the legislature had recently passed a more, as the legislature always does in California, passes more generous pension benefits. The probably the most important case is something called Betts versus Board of Administration of CalPERS. Burt Betts was the elected treasurer of California, late 50s, early 60s. Long after he had left that position in 1974, there was another jacking up of your pension benefits, and he sued, believing that he was under, he should be put under this new rubric. And the court found in his favor. However, the pull quote from this decision was, "The employee does not obtain prior to retirement any absolute right to fixed or specific benefits, but only to a substantial or reasonable pension." What that means is that what we have all been assuming, and I don't mean we, but what the California legal establishment, that paragon of good dealing, has always assumed is that you are not only, you're entitled right away the minute you get hired to everything that you're gonna get in the future. They can point to some court decisions that support that view. However, they always, all of these decisions, and I'm happy to talk afterwards about, you know, what the names of some of these decisions are. I read them so you don't have to. They always stop short of saying you're entitled to all future benefits, all future accruals. And that's really what we're dealing with right now. California is one of the few states where you're starting to see in this year's budget, you're starting to see problems with funding shortfalls for the pensions. And in most cases, this is still a problem that exists in the future. It exists because, actuarially, you're looking at what's happening and the number just keeps going up. The problem nationwide is at least $1 trillion in future unfunded pension benefits. It may be as high as $3 trillion. California's portion of that has been estimated as high as $500 billion. So it's something that really needs to be gotten under control, not for future employees. Anything that gets us into a two-tiered system where new hires come in under a 401k style package is not going to solve the problem, because it's existing people or retired people and what they're going to be getting in the future. Once you are retired, there is nothing legally that you can really do about it. Once the person is retired and collecting the benefits, short of declaring bankruptcy or something catastrophic like that, you're pretty much on the hook. However, until the person retires, there is far more leeway than has been assumed in the way the laws get made. And it's getting to an interesting crisis point in California. The Little Hoover Commission, which is this great group up in Sacramento, like everything in California, it's democratically controlled. However, it is sort of done in a way that tries to minimize the partisanship and is viewed as pretty much as, you know, the Jedi of California. When they say something, it's they're the real deal, and they're disinterested parties and so forth. They have actually broached this situation in a way that Scott Walker hasn't, in a way that Jerry Brown hasn't, in a way that Chris Christie hasn't, in saying that we need to deal with currently hired people. We need to deal with what they have accrued and what they're going to accrue. We need to revisit it in the courts. They've included cops and firefighters, which Scott Walker didn't, and Meg Whitman didn't when she was running for governor of California. It's Public Pensions for Retirement Security, a very long document, but it's actually more radical than anything you've seen from the rabid right-wingers or the libertarians out there, and they have broached the issue that this stuff needs to be revisited in the courts. I'm here to tell you that if you look back on the history of at least California court decisions, and I'll bet it's the same thing when you look to Wisconsin or you look to New Jersey or any of the other states where all this activity is happening, you're going to find a lot in old court decisions specifying, we're going to rule for the plaintiff in this case. However, we want to make it clear that we are not saying there's some ironclad obligation. There is language saying this is part of your compensation package, but there is a lot more contractual leeway than I think people want to admit. When this Little Hoover Commission report came out a couple of months ago, Bill Lockyer, who is now the treasurer of California, did a fairly unusual thing for a treasurer. He wrote this like 6 or 8 page screed attacking the thing, because at one point it had said actuaries say there's going to be trouble with our pension system, but in the footnote they only talked to one actuary. And it was like, at this level was the attack that he was making. This is a treasurer of California. He's been everything else in California, because California, we have term limits, but we also have this musical chairs where everybody's constantly shifting around in jobs. He has a long history of looking at these old decisions, seeing only where it gives him a chance to help out the unions and bump up the pension obligation. He's a very impeachable source. Among other things, he says that they twisted the words of the actuary they were quoting in this story. I called that guy up, who with the great punk rock sensibility that actuaries all have, didn't want to rock the boat at all. He was saying, I want to be clear. But he did say they did not distort my words. Everything they said was legitimate. This is the political climate you're dealing with in California. You really have a political class that's never going to make any action on this until they're forced to. I'm with Len in hoping that Jerry Brown will do something. When he does, it's all going to go to court. And the thing to keep in mind, hopefully nobody in this room will have to actually do anything about it, but for the people who are filing the amicus briefs and who are going to be on the side of reform when these things come to court, is that there is a lot less reason to believe these things are as contractually binding as your agreement to purchase a house or to purchase a car than has been advertised. Hope I went under my time, so hope that helped. And Anthony's next.
Thanks, Tim. Yesterday when I came in, I drove down US 1, and I was, it's my first time here in Southern California. I was like, oh, I get why, people like Southern California. It's much prettier than Washington, D.C. But now, hearing that the government system out here is not much better than Washington, D.C., maybe doesn't have as much of the appeal. Thank you guys for coming here. This is my first time at Reason Weekend. And there's a lot of exciting stuff that we have in the DC office looking at federal policy right now, whether it's an opportunity to go after the mortgage interest reduction, some sin taxes, federal trade policy. But the big thing that we have identified where Reason can have a substantive impact in the policy debate when it comes to macroeconomic policies is getting rid of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And it's one of the, Fannie Mae has been around since 1938. Freddie started in the late 60s. They have been sort of this leech on the side of America. The massive government institutions, they're now up to $6.5 trillion in terms of their assets. But we have, for the first time in all of it, sort of their 80-year history, a real shot at getting rid of them. And the people who are on our side now, they're not just Republicans, but there's the Treasury Department and even Barney Frank. So that's exciting news that I just kind of want to walk through today. So I want to start with sort of a question. How many people here own a home? Pretty much everybody. How many people think that or sort of believe throughout your life that owning a home is a good investment? This is something we've been taught. This is an investment tool. This is something we've heard. Maybe you have personally come across it. Maybe that's not the case. But this is this is the Case-Shiller Housing Price Index from basically then World War II to right now. And you can see the housing bubble pretty prominently here. But here's the important thing is that people point to this slope upwards in housing prices. And this is why policymakers believe that we need to have a public policy that promotes home ownership. This is why I was sitting in the offices of one of the top six banks 2 weeks ago talking with someone who works for them. He helped to write a lot of the Dodd-Frank legislation. He used to be in Washington and now is in the private sector. And we're sort of arguing back and forth of really whether or not the federal government really needs to have a role in basically defining what a safe mortgage is and whether or not the government needs to even have a role in promoting home ownership. And he said to me, he says, I just don't see another way that poor people can become wealthy other than by owning a home. Never mind the massive foreclosure crisis that we faced. But this is kind of what he points to. So I went and I grabbed the data, and I said, okay, so there is this, but what about if you adjust it for inflation? So here are the real prices of home price growth between the post-war and the mid-90s. They don't go anywhere. This is a basically a 3% or so growth in where this index stands. And you can pick, the reason I picked the mid-90s is there was a law passed in 1992, is the GSE Reform Act. It has a couple different names, but it basically, this is when we began to get affordable housing goals. This was a law that sort of kick-started Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and going from just sort of distorting home prices to actually beginning to cause the housing bubble itself. So this is also, again, adjusted for inflation prices. So this is real growth. So this is after that law is passed and begins to become implemented in the mid-90s. Housing prices double. So historically, housing prices, they pretty much stay the same. Post-war, all the way up to the mid-90s, then all of a sudden we see housing prices take off, but now it's fake. And we now know that all the gains that we thought that we were getting, if you bought a house in the top of the market in 2005, 2006, that's not the real price of your home. It's all sort of fake. And you sort of see this is the bubble effect and this is the dip. And this is what it looks like over time. So the first chart, that's why policymakers think that we need to have a Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, or we need to have some kind of government subsidy, some kind of government guarantee for home prices, because that's the only way people become wealthy. But that's not actually generating any real wealth. And given the massive foreclosure crisis that we have right now, given the fact that there is 3 to 4 years of supplies of home on the housing market today, which is going to take, that's going to take a massive amount of time to be able to sell off all these just empty homes. It's clear, the evidence is absolutely clear, that the United States government has no business whatsoever in trying to promote home ownership as this end-all be-all, as if that's the only way you can achieve an American dream and make something for yourselves in this country. There's a couple other reasons that we're trying to push into sort of the public policy debate as to why it's not the best idea to promote home ownership. One is, in the 21st century, we're an increasingly mobile society. According to the National Association of Realtors themselves, people only stay in their homes about an average of 7 years, and then they move to another home. Why do we need to have 30-year fixed-rate mortgages as this golden mortgage product that we couldn't live without if people only live in their homes at basically on average about 7 years? People move a lot. And if you look at unemployment data, there's been some interesting studies that have pointed to, of the 8 to 9% unemployment rate that we have right now, as much as 2% of that is attributable to low-income individuals in a home that they can't sell, and so they can't move somewhere else where they can get a job. So we had in the mid-90s, this idea of, we just need to get poor people into homes. We need low and middle-income families. We need to help them be able to buy a home, because that's the only way that they can achieve wealth. And we actually promoted fake wealth, and now they're stuck in homes that they can't sell and they can't move somewhere else to get a job. So you have all of this sort of like mounting evidence, and it's beginning to win the day. There is nobody that has a strong intellectual honest component, part of what their work is, that actually thinks that we need to have Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac anymore. It's from progressive economists like Dean Baker, even Simon Johnson, who advocates that we need to have the government go up and break the banks. He even says we shouldn't have Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Barney Frank last year on Larry Kudlow's show says, you know what, by the end of next year, I hope we get rid of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, because I was wrong. We shouldn't, we tried to help poor people. This is not the way to go about this. And then the Treasury Department this year issued a white paper that said, we don't need Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. We don't need affordable housing goals, and we should be able to get rid of them within 5 to 7 years. So that is the environment in which we're in Washington, D.C., where there's a very real chance to actually be able to move forward on trying to get rid of these guys. So how are we going to do it? I'll take that down. So what is the future? How do we go about this? What should the future of home ownership look like? And so this is where Reason's trying to step in and trying to define this. And we've worked very closely with Republican policymakers on trying to come up with, so what are the ideas that can actually take? Should we take a few steps forward this year? Should this be a 1-year process, 2-year process? Should we get rid of them over a 5-year period? We've written a number of papers. At the end of the day, the future of housing needs, there need to be no GSEs. No, we can't replace them with anything else. They can't stick around. They need to be gone. I would even advocate we shouldn't even privatize them. We just need to end them. Privatizing them means that we leave sort of this subtle sense, just like they were before, they were quasi-private entities, that they still sort of do have government backing. And they, you know, they could be monsters that come back to rear their heads. We just need to get rid of them completely. There can't be a government guarantee of any other kind. So there's a number of people, they're generally people in the industry. They're the home builders, they're the realtors, they're the mortgage bankers who want their government subsidy for their business, which you sort of understand their self-interest in that. But they're arguing that, well, if we don't have a Fannie and Freddie, at the very least, the government needs to have some kind of guarantee, because otherwise investors aren't going to buy mortgage-backed securities and no one will own a home. And you will have to pay, you know, 30% interest to be able to get a mortgage. It's simply not the case. There are literally trillions of dollars in that are invested in assets that are not backed by the government of any kind, because people want to get yield from their money. If you are investing in a treasury or a muni, you're getting very low interest back because it's very low risk. But people want to invest in something where they're going to get yield back. So we're working right now with some other organizations on trying to draw out companies that are going to be investing in this market to show that there's a massive amount of liquidity. We can have a fully private-backed mortgage market. And the other thing is there's this notion that the government should define what a risky mortgage is. So in the Dodd-Frank law that was passed last year, there were two things. One, the law told the banking regulators to come up with a qualified residential mortgage, which is essentially banking regulators coming together and saying, this is a really safe mortgage, and if you have this mortgage, it's probably not going to default. And then the law said, if you are going to originate or own or securitize any other mortgage, you have to hold a certain amount of risk, and this rule called risk retention. And there's this notion in Washington, even among some conservatives, that the government should be forcing people to hold capital against their mortgage risk. But this it basically assumes that the private sector isn't capable of measuring its own risk. And people point to the housing bubble and they say, well, look, the private sector clearly wasn't able to measure its own risk. It didn't have enough capital, simply missing the fact that if you're too big to fail, if you know that the government's going to come behind you at the end of the day, all of your measures for managing your own risk are completely skewed. So if we have a means that if you are investing in mortgages, and you invest in poor mortgages, and those go bad, and you fail, that there's a way to liquidate that company, and that they aren't going to be bailed out, we do not need any rules for risk retention of any kind. And there is it's nerdy, but it's pretty hilarious that the rules that the regulators defined a really safe mortgage as have now freaked out all of the members of the housing community. So the home builders and the community bankers and the mortgage bankers who all supported Dodd-Frank, they're now terrified because it got defined as this really, really narrow definition that's gonna run a lot of them out of business. So they were all for government regulation when they thought it was going to help them, and now they see the regulation come down and it could wipe out half the mortgage bankers. Now all of a sudden they're going back. Now they have to team up with the Republicans on maybe trying to get rid of this altogether, which is, it goes to show that if you really think that you can have a sort of a long-term sense of manipulation, and then something called the Tea Party comes along, you should think twice. So reasons role in all of this. We have there's two approaches. So there's two approaches to going about this. On the one hand, we could hope that Congress passes one big bill that sort of tackles this head on, deals with every part of getting rid of Fannie and Freddie with their multifamily business, with low income, with FHA, that sort of puts a sunset on how long they're going to be around. And when that thing goes down, then we know that they are no more. The problem is, with split Congress, politically speaking, it's almost impossible that's going to get through. However, we still hope and we're still writing about what this sort of comprehensive process would look like, because if that's advancing in any form, at least in the House, that it shows this is what, sort of at the end of the day, this is our flag in the sand, this is what we want to work on. At the same time, we've sort of, I testified in February on a number of short-term steps that Congress could sort of take in going about this. And this involves doing simple things like raising the fee that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac charge to investors for guaranteeing payment on the securities, raising that fee to what the market would charge if the market was actually sort of pricing that out. You know, if you have the taxpayers behind Fannie and Freddie, they can charge a very low fee, and it ranges from 15 to 20 basis points. What that really should be is something like 100 to 150 basis points. They are grossly underpricing what they should be charging. And so there's just one bill that was introduced. It's already been passed out of a House subcommittee that simply says Fannie and Freddie have to, over the next 2 years, raise that fee to what they would charge if they didn't have a government subsidy. And there's ways of measuring that. There's already, the estimates are already out there. It can be done. And the fun thing is that's going to wind up driving them out of business anyway. So even if there isn't a law that says this is when you're done, this is one means of going about sort of a backdoor of driving them out of business. We need to lower the rates that Fannie and Freddie, or the size of mortgages that they're allowed to purchase. Right now, they can purchase mortgages up to $729,000, which means that government is subsidizing homes as high as $729,000. Why this is necessary to promote, you know, low and middle income sort of home ownership is absolutely beyond me. But every hearing, there is some congressman who gets up and he says, if we lower this, this is going to be terrible for the people in my district. It's going to be terrible to the high income people in your district, absolutely. But it's, you know, it's absolutely necessary. And there, we have a handful of other, in my testimony in February, I listed out 10 things that should be done. Of those 10 things, 8 have already been introduced into law and passed out of a subcommittee in the House, and have a pretty good shot of at least passing the House. And they're designed to be largely bipartisan, because the language that a lot of these laws has sort of put into place mirrors exactly what the Treasury Department has said, and sort of backing up where we stand on this stuff. So I mean, at the end of the day, I'm optimistic about where we stand in this fight. It's going to be another 1 to 2 year fight at the very least. And at the end of the day, there is a Democratic Party that isn't even in Congress, that isn't even aligned with its own Treasury Department. So I would still only give this, you know, as optimistic as I am, I would still only give this a 20% chance that this, you know, passes in the next 2 years. But at the very least, we are in a point in the argument where the GSEs will not be around for that much longer. They are not around for another 20 years. We have a very real chance of going after them. And I'm happy to answer any more questions on the, you know, technical side of this, or talk with you guys elsewhere. So thank you. Thank you.